This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It is episode 400. Oi. The man doesn't know when to quit. We are 1/5 of the way to 2,000 episodes. And I did figure it up the other day, and if I live into my 90s, I think. So you basically got 1,600 episodes left to go to get to 2,000. 52 episodes a week, or a year. So we'll say 50 just to make it easy. So that's 32 years left. I'm 58, so 32 years if I... If I live to be 90, I'll make 2,000 episodes. So there you go. Oi. 32 years. What will the world look like 32 years from now? That's going to be fascinating. That's going to be very, very fascinating. 32 years from now, I should have most of the major series that I'd like to write finished up. Another 8-9 years or so, if things keep going as they are. 9 years. I should be finished with the Windfall series. And then there's a series that nobody likes that I wrote called That Fated Shore, that I have the first book done on that. There's two more books behind that. And then there's at least 3 more, if not 6 more books in the Far Forth Fables series. And then there are 3 or 4 books left in The Sun, the Wind, and the Rain. There's a whole other series called The God War Chronicles. So there's plenty to write, but I am going to much more take my time. At least I think I am. Who knows? There, you know, when I'm not working anymore, when I have 6 hours a day to write, just plow through stuff, maybe I'll slow down my writing speed, but there's something to be said for just plowing it out. So who knows? Who knows? Who knows how that will go? I am still in the glamorous part of writing. I'm doing the editing, the line editing, based on information coming back from the beta readers. I did give the beta readers a final deadline of next Tuesday. So I think I'll be okay there. I might be finishing up all the information I currently have from beta readers today, but I did reshoot the cover, so I've got to go and make that work. And so that'll take a little time. There is a, when I did that reshoot, there was this hat on eBay. It was a Victorian mourning hat. And it had a dead crow on it. And I wanted so much to get that hat. Use it. But it was $45. So I was like, eh. But, you know, I have always gone out to, like, Shutterstock and those kind of places to get my background pieces that I montage together. You know, I was thinking the other day, I've got some covers coming up that are going to require a much fancier costume. And I was thinking, you know, you could just go out to Shutterstock and see if you could find that stuff on Shutterstock. Spend $10, download the photo, warp it, woof it, until it fits the kids, and just, you're done. A little more work for me, but I don't know. So we'll see. We'll see. I did reshoot the kids for the cover, used more Victorian outfits for them. So I'm going to try to get that worked out on the covers. Although, you know, if I can go out and I don't know. I'll see. That, I don't know. Up to this point, I've always dressed them up and just used them what they're dressed in. Because it was a whole lot easier, but I don't know. That might be interesting to try to see if there's... I'd have to find just the right outfit with just the right lighting patterns. Because whenever I take my own pictures, I'm not that good. I mean, I basically just put everything on auto, and so I don't get the type of output. I always have to massage it and run it through stuff and yada yada yada. So I don't know. Anyways, so that's all going well. You know, I think I'm on target. Well, I'm definitely on target to get the book out and finished by January 1st. And to take a little time over the Christmas holiday. My major client is going to be closed from the 23rd, that Friday before Christmas, the 23rd, all the way through the 1st. So they'll be back open on the 2nd. So I have that entire weekend free, so it'll be good. I think as far as topic today, I think I mentioned last week, I'm pretty sure I did, that one of the things that's been fascinating to me about a side effect out of this election is that I found myself, as I'm flipping through my feed on Facebook, I found myself looking at the feeds that are from the New York Times and the Washington Post and whatever, and looking at and going, oh yeah, well, that's biased. It's probably not even true. Which is an interesting reaction. I mean, in the past, it's always been, well, yeah, they're probably a little biased, but at least their facts are right. At least the facts are right. But man, after this election, when they were just dead wrong about so many things, and it was just so slanted, it like has flipped a switch in my brain or something. And that's been a very interesting thing. And to see all the major news outlets come out and admit, well, yeah, we got to be more like cheerleaders than reporters, and we'll do better, you know. But then you see them coming out with headlines that are still seemingly so slanted. I feel like I've talked about this already. Can't remember. Anyways, if I did, that's because I'm getting senile and I'm getting old. I did come across this very interesting article called How We Got to Post-Truth. And what this article doesn't include is it doesn't include the philosophy of relativism, which is a very important piece of this. Because if you go back couple hundred years, there was a certain honor that was paid the truth, because there was a belief in truth, that there was what happened or didn't happen. And with the advance of relativism, it's more an existentialism. It's more about, well, what is happening to me? And that attitude filters down, well, here's my truth, and you have your truth, and you know, and there are no black and whites, and it's all just your interpretation. And so while this article does not specifically refer to that, I think that that's a pretty good, you know, there... I think a lot of this stuff started there, and now it's working its way all out through society. And then obviously, one of the big things here is the dissemination of information through the internet. So there is no more official gatekeeper of information. You know, this article talks about in the groggy aftermath of the 2016 election, slightly more than half Americans are still in shock. In an effort to understand not only how Trump happened, but how they had so underestimated his appeal, editorialists have loudly pointed fingers at Facebook. Uh-oh. There's two sheriff cars going into Crystal Cave. There's a little cave out by my house. It's just like 2 miles south of me. And it was a little kind of touristy, attraction-y thing. And the man who ran it died several months ago. They've been trying to sell it. But last I looked, they had a price tag of $1.8 million on it. They haven't sold it. I just came by there and there were two police cars going in there. Interesting. And that's a bit of news. It was factual and it's the truth. So anyways, everybody's pointing fingers at Facebook, which according to a new Pew report is now used daily by 68% of the population. Facebook, they wrote, is uniquely responsible both for a seemingly unmitigated spread of fake news and for serving up news stories that fit users' own beliefs, trapping us in our own filter bubbles. And I don't think there's any question that the internet, in its deluge of data, has caused all sorts of interesting things. Because not only is there the reporting of news that has a philosophical slant, but there is also a ton of clickbait stuff that is out there. And some of it's just blatantly lies. They said, for instance, on November 11th, a website called the Conservative Daily Post tweeted a headline, "Maryland refusing Electoral College, Hillary given presidency as more United States follow. Click here." Well, the story was a complete fabrication. And it was based on the details of the 2000 decision by Maryland's Electoral College voters to give their vote to the national popular vote winner. But people clicked on it. Now, they said the Conservative Daily Post later removed the tweet, but all the retweets and the Facebook posts and the story itself remains online. And so now, there have always been rags, yellow journalistic rags, but we knew they were rags, or we kind of knew. The problem here is that it's all just mixed in among all the stuff. Got your birthday parties getting reported, you got your New York Times stories, you get your Washington Post stories, and then you've got all this other stuff that is, some of it's just slanted. Some of it, though, exists only for the purpose for you to click on it so that they can show their ads. They quoted a guy named Craig Silverman. He said, "There's lots of folks who are not prepared for this huge onslaught of information and figuring out how to deal with that," Craig Silverman said, who reports on fake news for BuzzFeeds and revealed that teenagers in the Balkans were running fake news sites in support of Donald Trump to make money. Said even President Obama has weighed in on the issue, citing a concern for democratic freedoms during a press conference Thursday. He said, "If we are not serious about the facts and what is true and what is not," he said, particular in the social media era when so many get their information from sound bites and snippet off their phones, if we can't discriminate between serious arguments and propagandas, then we have problems. Well, okay, that's not really that profound. But the question is, what are we going to do about all this? What are we going to do about bias? What are we going to do about fake news that only exists for clickbait? I mean, if you go on in the article, it all goes back, you know, they trace a lot of it back. In the last 15 years, blogging has changed the way news is written, reported, and distributed. No longer do writers and pundits require a printing press or much financial wherewithal. They simply need a computer and an internet connection. And there's no filters. There's no editorial board. There's no one saying, you know, I think this is slanted here or not slanted. And in addition to all that, at the same time, this point of view journalism that became popular within the last multiple years, wherein reporters intimate or disclose their subjective opinions on their stance or particular issue, began taking hold. Which is really interesting that news organizations, you know, would do this. The rejection of the view from nowhere style of reporting, an attempt to appear unbiased in factual presentation, may have helped to foster an environment in which readers mistrust reporters who have a personal view on a given topic. And, I mean, to me, when I look at that, I ask myself, why would reporters, when there has been a tradition for many, 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 many years of reporting facts, why, where did this trend come from? This idea that what we need to do now is offer our opinions. That sounds like ego to me. Sounds like flesh. It sounds a little bit like desperation, because maybe some of those bloggers out there who could say just anything they wanted, you know, maybe it's financial, because it's money, because every entity, once it becomes aware of its existence, has a basic first principle that eclipses all others. How do I continue to survive? And the news organizations have been battered for multiple years. The newspapers have been battered. Theoretically, there was always a divide between advertising and the news, because the news was sacrosanct. Then you get all these bloggers out there who are just writing whatever they want to write, and they don't have that type of restriction. And they actually start pulling away some of the revenue. But all of this, and he talks about the fact, she talks about in this article, blogs have blossomed into full-blown media companies and brought with them a sarcastic, edgy voice that can undermine their credibility. Fake or poorly reported news has adopted a tone of authority. The resulting is a jostling of the media landscape where conspiracy theorists become indistinguishable from credible sources. I mean, it's really very interesting. While 65% of those polled earlier this year turned to the web for their news on the election, 78% of people watched television to get the latest on Trump and Clinton. Overall, 57% of people frequently flick on the tube to find out what's going on in the world. That's compared with 38% of Americans who regularly get their news from social media. So, obviously, social media has some impact, but it's not complete yet. But the trends are certainly there. More and more people in the last year, the daily Facebook use among U.S. adults rose from 70 to 76%. And the influence of those posts is growing too. 20% of surveys respondents said that social media has altered their position on a political issue, and 17% it says has changed their view of a specific candidate. So, you know, in the old days, newspapers used to be the gatekeepers of information, but that's done. And I think, honestly, it feels like right now, I may completely change my mind later, but it feels like right now that one of the casualties of this election has been the refuting and the debunking, the apparent debunking of the mainstream news outlets. And it's interesting I don't, you know, how do you come back from that as an organization? Once you've had such a horrific discrediting, this is a fascinating time to be alive. The article said, the rise of social media platforms as curators and distributors of news content has raised some questions about what civic responsibilities they have and whether these gatekeepers should be filtering out factually inaccurate articles or reducing the echo chamber effect. The answers don't seem immediately apparent. In the Washington Post, fake news blogger Paul Horner admits to not only making up stories that spread for virulently online, but to creating fake source materials for other stories. Much of it, he said, was quickly picked up by the supporters of the president-elect. He said, "I think Trump is in the White House because of me. His followers don't fact-check anything. They'll post anything, believe anything. His campaign manager posted my story about a protester getting paid $3,500 as fact, like I made that up. I posted a fake ad on Craigslist." Now, what's interesting is Mark Zuckerberg has, you know, tried to come out and said, "Oh, that's crazy. There's no way Facebook influenced the election." And he said, you know, less than 1% of the content on Facebook is fake news or deceptive content. And Facebook has come out and said, well, they're going to start screening this, and we're not, you know, we're not gonna. Yeah, sorry, I'm scanning this as I go. I'm a little bit scattered this morning. It was Thanksgiving yesterday. You know, Facebook has come out now and says, "Well, we're not gonna let those fake news sites advertise." Yeah, okay. So, okay, fine. First of all, how are you gonna identify those sites? What kind of protest, you know? If you simply say, well, that's slanted, that's one thing. You know, how many factual errors do they have to get through? This is going to get very difficult. And, you know, in a country where we supposedly have freedom of speech and freedom of the press, how do you start enforcing this kind of thing? Where you say, well, you can't write that fake facts thing and then fake facts thing and fake news thing, and or we're not going to put you, we're not going to let you show your stuff. What? Hold what? What if they say it's satire? There's so freedom of speech, freedom of the press. Wow. You know, it really relies on truth. And if there is a paucity of truth, that's bad. And that's flesh. So, about the only thing I know to do is if I find something that I think is cool and I want to pass on, before I pass it on, I should really do my best to do research and see if it is true before I let stuff affect me. I'll give you a case in point. Screaming headlines. Election machines may have been hacked. We may need to check the results in three swing states. I mean, that's what they lead with. It's always the election machines may have been hacked. There may be a problem. They're swing states. There may be a recount there. We need to, you know, and then you dig down into the articles and you actually start reading through the articles. And it starts off with, yes, computer scientists have looked at the data and they believe there is a problem. And you look deeper, 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 deeper. Finally, one of the people who raised this, he comes out and says, well, there's no evidence that it's been hacked. There's just an odd anomaly of data. And that could very well be because the polling was off. But then in response to that, Jill Stein goes out and she raises $3 million, you know, to pay for the recounts, blah, 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 blah. It goes on and on and on and on. But I would just caution, for me, I've just always found it's good to kind of slow myself down. If you want to read the article, read the article. Maybe go out to Snopes, look at Snopes, although some people will claim Snopes is biased as well. Let's just take a pause before we react emotionally to something we might read and retweet, you know, repost. Just slow down. And recognize that we have come to an era in the world of post-truth. We are in it now. I don't see how in the world we're ever going to be able to back out of this. Because the flesh is going to constantly be at work, no matter what your political, where you are in the political spectrum, the flesh is going to constantly be at work trying to harden that position, trying to make you less open-minded, trying to make you more judgmental, trying to make you more condemning, more angry, more merciless. And each of us, I think the best thing each of us can do is try to work against that. Just do our best to live lives of kindness and mercy and gentleness. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.